You're listening to LGRadio.online. Welcome to In the Benny Green Archives.
What a day this has been. What a rare mood I'm in. Why, it's almost like being in love. There's a smile on my face for the whole human race. Why, it's almost like being in love. All the music of life seems to be like a bell that is ringing for me. And from the way that I feel when the bell starts to peal, I would swear I was falling. I could swear I was falling. It's almost like being in love.
The sound is unique, the style instantly identified, and it sets a frightful problem for the biographer. The problem is this. What is Frank Sinatra? We know what he was. He was a singer, a strolling player who sang the best songs and sang them so much better than anyone else that there was never a runner-up. That's what Sinatra was. But in the process of being it, he turned into something quite different, something which makes the biographer's job impossible. By the very force of his art, Sinatra has become social history. But even that doesn't answer the case. I suppose I could draw up a list of his technical virtues, those delightfully distinctive vowel sounds, which make some of the diphthongs so succulent you can almost reach out and touch them. The wonderful musicianly sense of phrasing, the exuberance at up-tempo, the affecting melancholia of the ballads of unrequited love, the consistency of performance, the adamant championing of good songs, no matter what their vintage. All this and more I could spend time on. But there's something much more important, and it's this. Sinatra, by the application of his art and his personality, has insinuated himself into all our lives so utterly that anything any one of us says about him has to be personal, a one-to-one relationship. A freak situation where a remote stranger is expressing on behalf of each of us the most intimate thoughts, dreams, emotions, memories.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story I think you should know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. Make it one for my babe and one more for the road.
I know men of my own vintage who to this day cannot listen to recordings like that at all, simply because the vividness with which they evoke lost loves, lost times, is too painful to bear. And I know still other men, sometimes the same ones, who cherish certain of the recordings as symbols of the apex of their lives. In the face of all this, I think technical analysis will be mere charlatanism. To come to terms with what Sinatra has done, we have to come to terms with ourselves. And that is a truly remarkable thing. No other entertainer this century has achieved that, or even thought of achieving it. Sinatra seems to have done it without trying. He was born in Hoboken, New Jersey, December the 12th, 1915, of a Sicilian father and an Italian mother.
My father and my mother came from the opposite ends of Italy, and I make a joke with audiences about I'm glad my old man jumped ship, but he was only 5 years old when he came over. The kind of upbringing they gave me as an only child couldn't have been better. No child I know has ever had better treatment from their parents. It seemed that I got enough education until I came to a stage in my life when I heard a couple of music sounds, and I said, that's enough education.
A famous historian has said that when taking the measure of some great figure, the question he asks himself is, what was happening in the world during the man's teenage years? The moment we do that with Sinatra, we start to discover one of the factors which motivated him.
Another bride, another groom, another sunny honeymoon, another season, another reason for making whoopee.
Heard the breeze in the trees singing weird melodies, and they played that as the start of the blues.
Some of those tunes have survived, others have become quaintly outdated. They're slow or fast, come from Broadway or Tin Pan Alley, were designed for girls or boys. But they all have two things in common. They all date from the late 1920s, and Sinatra's revived every one of them and dozens of others. That has been the key to his career. But he's taken upon himself the mission to save good songs from oblivion. And it so happens that the good songs of his adolescence came up right in the middle of a golden age of popular songwriting. And they must have been the first songs he ever sang in public.
Well, the beginning came when I was a boy of about 10 or 11 years old, and I started singing with the school choir and a church choir, and on picnics and what have you, whenever there was a chance to sing. And it was then that I realized that far back that I wanted to become a singer. And through school, into high school, I continued singing with the orchestras at the different dances we had, school dances and otherwise. And then it progressed and progressed into working as a professional rather than an amateur.
The first hard date in the professional rise is September the 8th, 1935, when Sinatra, as part of the Hoboken Four, appeared on the Major Bowles Amateur Hour on radio from the Capitol Theatre, New York. For the next 6 months, the group toured America. Sinatra's cut was $50 a week, until an argument started within the group that led to Sinatra leaving and going back to New York. Here, he laid siege to the radio stations and offered to sing for nothing. He later claimed to have once done 18 shows in 1 week for a total wage of 70 cents, travel expenses. Then, a musician friend introduced him to a band leader called Harold Arden, who was leading a small band at a New Jersey roadhouse called the Rustic Cabin. The job only paid $15 a week, but it had what Sinatra valued at that time more than money, a regular radio link. For that $15, Sinatra sang with the band, acted as MC, waited at tables, stayed there a year and a half, saw his salary raised to $25 a week, met and married his Nancy, that was in February 1939, just about the time that a newly formed big band was coming up with Harry James, the star trumpeter in Benny Goodman's band, leading it. One night, James, who had caught a fragment of Sinatra's voice on a broadcast, came over to the cabin to hear more. The following night he came back again and made an offer which was too good to refuse, $75 a week.
All or nothing at all. Half a love never appealed to me. If your heart never could yield to me, then I'd rather have nothing at all or nothing at all. If it's love, there is no in between. Why begin and cry for something that might have been? No, I'd rather have nothing at all. Oh, please don't bring your lips up close to my cheek. Don't smile or I'll be lost beyond recall. The kiss in your eyes and the touch of your hand makes me weep, and my heart may grow dizzy and fall. And if I fell under the spell of your call, I would be caught in the undertow. And so you see, I've got to say no, no. All or nothing at all.
Before Tommy Dorsey, I was with Harry James. As a matter of fact, that orchestra was the first so-called name orchestra, and even then Harry was not a name. He was just beginning himself. The orchestra was about 6 months old, and I joined the band about then, and I spent about 8 months or a year with the orchestra, and then I went over to Tommy Dorsey.
Of course, the James Band wasn't obscure for very long. By 1942, with Glenn Miller off the road and into uniform, it was the James Band that took over as the biggest big band attraction in America. But by then, Frank had long since moved on, from the James Band to the second and last of his band leader employers. Now, Tommy Dorsey had been around for a long time by the time Sinatra went to work for him. A sugary trombonist with a well-drilled dance band tinged here and there with genuine jazz influences, it was just the sort of group that Sinatra could learn from. He once defined his days with Dorsey in a beautiful phrase. He called his time there as like attending a cross-country college. But it appears to have been a college run by a martinet. Most of the people who passed through the band remember Tommy Dorsey as a man whose temperament gave the lie to the saccharine sweetness of his trombone playing. Nelson Riddle, who joined the band not so long after Sinatra left it, remembered the Dorsey days a shade ruefully.
He was a disciplinarian. He was extremely strict. And in the times when he drank, which was just prior to my coming on the band, he could be rather vicious. He was a very strict man as far as getting your job done. Tommy's own life was somewhat undisciplined in the sense that drinking itself to excess is a sign of lack of discipline. staying up all night in utter disregard of his health shows a certain lack of discipline. Where music was concerned, he was highly disciplined, both in his playing and in his management of an orchestra.
Nobody gets sentimental over Tommy Dorsey these days. Too many eyewitnesses like Nelson Riddle, and they all corroborate each other's recollections. But if Dorsey was a problem, how did it work out with someone like Sinatra, who was never inclined to let people push him around? One of the other singers in the band was Joe Stafford, and she hits on a pretty phrase to describe the relationship between Dorsey and his new singer.
Sort of an armed truce, I would say. A very great respect for each other's abilities, but with two very volatile personalities, which at times cannot help but clash. But with respect for each other, always.
Joe Stafford joined the band in December 1939, and so she was there to see the arrival of this volatile young singer.
We were playing at the Palmer House in Chicago. We then went to a theater in Milwaukee. And we knew we were going to have a new boy singer, but we did not know who he was or anything about him. And we never saw Frank, as a matter of fact, until the first show. We were on stage, and Tommy announced, you know, they had a new boy singer, and out came this rather frail-looking young man with a whole bunch of hair, and not terribly impressive to look at, but sang about no more than 8 bars of Stardust, as I remember, and a great hush fell over the theater, and you knew you were hearing something completely new and completely unique and completely wonderful.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song. The melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration. Is in the stardust of a song,
and beside a garden wall, when the stars were bright,
you were in my arms. The nightingale told its fairy tale of paradise where roses grew, though I dream in vain. In my heart it always will remain, my stardust melody,
the memory of love's refrain.
He said, monumental talent, something that would, that they had not heard until then. In spite of Crosby's great popularity, this was entirely different. He was unique at that time. In my personal opinion, you haven't heard anything like it since either. He was just so good. I don't know how else to put it. He was just so good.
Though I dream in vain, in my heart it always will remain. stardust melody.
The memory of love's refrain.
The memory of love's refrain.
Another eye and ear witness of the Dorsey episode was the trumpeter arranger Cy Oliver, who never forgot the supreme confidence that Sinatra had, even in those very early days. He appeared to know exactly what he wanted, where he was going, and how he was going to get there. One journalist of the period later remembered that, comparatively unknown as he then was, Sinatra asked the journalist to put him, Sinatra, on the front cover of his magazine. The logic behind the request was that he would have to put it there one day, so why not now, when it would help most? Cy Oliver's recollection matches that story.
Sinatra, from the very beginning, from the time I met him, impressed me as being a guy who had everything. He would go all the way. He had supreme confidence, and he had great talent, and he was bright, he was smart, and it was inevitable that what happened should happen. I mean, you could see it. Of course, as his popularity increased, the more he recorded, the more records he became as important to the records as the band, you know, as Tommy himself. Tommy would be the first to admit that. It was a gradual process, but as I say, it was an inevitable thing. You could see it happening.
Oliver was one of the people Sinatra remembered later. He always did have an abiding affection for a good musician, and Oliver was something more than that. Years later, they collaborated on a reconstruction of the Dorsey days. And when it came to how to go about it, it wasn't Oliver, but Oliver and Sinatra.
Well, he usually contributes something in anything that he does. He's full of ideas. He's a very talented man. I did an album with him several years ago called I Remember Tommy. The content of the album was tunes that he had either done with or that had been associated with the Dorsey band. Not necessarily the same arrangements, but a new presentation of the tunes. And we discussed how we would do them before I did the arrangements. So many of the ideas were his.
It will be interesting to know what ideas. Well, that's not so hard to find out. The original Dorsey band was the strict tempo dance band par excellence, and it was Dorsey's breath control that held the great fascination for Sinatra.
He was the best shot I had, because here I was sitting, and there he was doing it, except that his back was to me all the time. And I used to look at his jacket. I figured if you take a breath, your coat's going to move a little bit, but it never moved. So I used to kind of lean around and see what he was doing around the front. But his face was covered by his hand. Obviously, you see a trombone player. And after about a year and a half with the orchestra one night, I was learning. It was happening. But I was impatient. I wanted to be better. In other words, I began singing 4 bars without breathing. Then I was singing 6 bars without breathing. And he could do 8 to 10 bars without breathing. But then he said to me, then finally one night he turned around, he said to me, he did a solo and he turned around when the orchestra took over. And he said, haven't you seen it yet? And I said, no, I haven't. I can't see it. And he explained to me that the reason that I can't see it is that in playing the instrument, you cover the mouthpiece with practically your whole hand, and he was getting a breath in the corner of his mouth. So he said to me, you cannot possibly do that because you're singing with your mouth wide open. He said, you're going to have to devise another way to do that. So I did. I started to work on it. And I was doing the same thing, except I wasn't squeezing it in the corner. I was taking a breath normally between syllables.
In this arrangement done by Oliver for the band and vocalist, you can hear the romanticism of a whole generation. As the music unfolds, you can smell the musk rising from the dance floor, the glitter ball flinging its dappled shadows across the darkened hall, young people shuffling through the strictly formal rituals of the mating dance.
Without a song, the day would never end. Without a song, the road would never bend. When things go wrong, a man ain't got a friend. Without a song, that field of corn would never see a plow. That field of corn would be deserted now. A darky's born, he ain't no good no how, without a saw. I've got my trouble and woe, but sure as I know the Jordan will roll, and I'll get along as a song is strung in my soul. I'll never know what makes the grass so tall. I'll never know what makes the rain to fall. I only know there ain't no love at all without a song.
Beautifully tailored, perfectly rendered, but not quite the sort of stuff that legends are built on. The impressive breath control is derived from Dorsey playing the trombone, certainly. But you couldn't imagine many dancers storming the bandstand to get a touch of Sinatra, or gazing at him in the realization that this was going to be the definitive sound of their lives, the one which would always symbolize for them their own youthful dreams. Now keep that recording of Without a Song in mind, because later on it becomes highly pertinent to the question, what did Sinatra contribute to the tactics of orchestrators like Cy Oliver? In the time Sinatra spent with the Dorsey Band, the profession quickly realized that there was something here nobody had bargained for. In the 1940 popularity polls run by the magazine Billboard, Sinatra was placed 22nd among the singers, it being said at the time that there were only 22 band singers on the road. First place went to Ray Eberly of the Glenn Miller Band, second to Jack Leonard, who had left the Dorsey Band just before Sinatra joined it, and third was Bob Eberly with Jimmy Dorsey. A year later, Sinatra was placed first. And even more remarkable, in the Downbeat poll for America's Best Male Singer, Sinatra was again first, with his great hero Crosby pushed into second place. By the start of 1942, it was getting silly. The Dorsey Band with Frank Sinatra was in danger of becoming Sinatra with the Dorsey Band. In the January, Sinatra was again placed first in the national polls. And before the month was out, he was making his own solo recordings.
Night and day, you are the one. Only you beneath the moon. The sun, whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you day and night, night and day. Why is it so that this longing for you follows wherever I go? In the roaring traffic's boom, or in the silence of my lonely room, I think of you day and night, night and day. Under the hide of me, there's an oh such a hungry yearning burning inside of me, and its torment won't be through till you let me spend my life making love to you day and night, night and day. Night and day under the hide of me. There's an oh, such a hungry yearning burning way down inside of me. And its torment won't ever be through till you let me spend my life making love to you day and night, night and day.
The entire landscape of popular singing and the touring bands had changed.
I decided that somebody should challenge Crosby because he had had the throne for, well, I don't know, so many years. And I thought maybe they're ready for a new kind of singer or a different kind of singer. Also, I did it because I realized that there were singers with other orchestras who were better than I was. And if they had gone out before me, they would have made it tougher for me to make a mark. So I consequently left the band and took my shot, big shot at it.
When Sinatra says there were better singers than him around, who's he thinking of? Ray Eberly, probably. Dick Haymes, just possibly. But it's interesting that he believed that the first one away from the starting gate would win the race. In retrospect, we can see that no matter how much Sinatra might have delayed his solo career, the end result would have been the same. So Sinatra went solo, and in his own words, all hell broke loose. The key date here is December the 30th, 1942, when he was squeezed into the Benny Goodman Show at New York's Paramount Theatre as an extra attraction. Goodman didn't seem to know who he was and announced him with his customary generous nature with, "And now, Frank Sinatra." It certainly was. Before that engagement was finished, so was the big band era, and Sinatra was an international celebrity. Life magazine called it the proclamation of a new era. But in spite of that, it was exactly that. Bobby Sox hysteria, jokes about skinny crooners, the big floppy bow ties, the lean and hungry look, the gaunt cheeks. It seemed that half the women in America were bent on mothering him. The crowds grew to such proportions and the hysteria mounted so dangerously that bodyguards had to be used to get the boy in and out of theatres where he was appearing. But still, nobody suspected the extent of the demand for Sinatra. This suddenly became clear in October 1944, when he went back to the Paramount Theatre and turned the whole city of New York upside down. Queues started to form the night before. 10,000 young ticket buyers waited to get inside. 20,000 more clogged Times Square. Over 400 police reserves were thrown in. 20 radio cars, 2 emergency trucks, 50 extra ushers inside the theatre. The box office totally destroyed in the stampede. Pedestrians trampled underfoot, mass fainting. On the third day, chaos inside the theatre. Sinatra starts to sing. Suddenly, a dissenting man in the audience hits the singer with a rotten egg. Pandemonium. Hundreds of angry Bobby Soxers converge on the egg thrower and attack him. Police rescue him and then throw him out. In Chicago, Sinatra's train windows are shattered and a priest is trampled on. In Pittsburgh, local school schedules are destroyed by absenteeism on the day of Sinatra's appearance. Girls smuggle themselves into his hotel rooms, into his car boot. They bribe chambermaids to be allowed to lie on his used bedsheets. It snows and girls fight over his footprints. They camp outside his New Jersey home. In the Waldorf Astoria, an elegant lady accosts him in the foyer and begs him to autograph her bra. Why? Wartime degeneracy, some said. Shrewd press agents, others said. But it was the same inside radio studios. The almost hypnotic power over audiences across the age range. Although the publicity stunts were shrewd, and although there was a war on, Sinatra's voice was something outstanding. Proof that it had not been given due credit in the beginning was now proved in a most dramatic way. On August the 31st, 1939, Sinatra had recorded a song with the James Band. Total sales, 8,000 copies. 3 years later, with Sinatra poised to go solo, a dispute between the recording companies and the musicians' union led to an all-out ban on instrumental recordings. The record companies started ransacking the cupboards for anything they could release. Someone thought of this old James flop. Now, the situation was very different. The James Band was riding high, Sinatra even higher. The record was reissued, only instead of saying Harry James with vocal by Frank Sinatra, the label read Sinatra accompanied by Harry James. The disc was re-released May 1943. By July, it was number one on the hit parade. It sold just under 1 million copies. By now, Sinatra was making his first picture for RKO. Songs by Jimmy McHugh.
I couldn't sleep a wink last night because we had that silly fight. I thought my heart would break the whole night through. I knew that you'd be sorry, and I'm sorry too. I didn't have my favorite dream, the one in which I hold you tight. I had to call you up this morning to see if everything is still all right. Yes, I had to call you up this morning, 'cause I couldn't sleep a wink last night.
Because of the time lag in the release of movies in Britain, the songs from Higher and Higher never made a local impact till halfway through 1944, a fact which emerged from the welter of research undertaken by newspapers when the anniversary of the Allied invasion of Europe became news. In the week when troops landed on the Normandy beaches, two of the first five places in the British hit parade were occupied by Sinatra. I Didn't Sleep a Wink Last Night, and This Is a Lovely Way to Spend an Evening. Not very long after this, Sinatra took advantage of a clause in his RKO contract, allowing him to make one picture a year for some other company by doing a musical over at MGM. It was one of those sailors on leave stories masterminded by Gene Kelly.
I had no qualms that Frank was very rhythmic and very athletic, could learn to move. He just had to have somebody who would take the time with him. And he had to be eager to do what he was. And we just sweated it out and never went beyond his capacities any more than if I did a singing number with him. I certainly couldn't hold my breath the way he does, like a trombone, and you know, and glide up to a note. It's fantastic, you know. But that was all. It took in time and sweat. But he realized that he had done two pictures of RKO, which were flop pictures, and it was a paradox that here he was the biggest hit in America, and his pictures were flops, you know. And he had to get his hands off that imaginary mic and move around. He knew that. Frank was always a very bright guy. He was bright when he was born, I think. And he knew his best work was done when he could do it quickly. The more takes you did with Frank, he knew he'd lose energy. He liked to do things right off. That means that a lot of people interpreted that as he didn't like to study. He knew his lines. And his first take, if you ever directed, which I did, was usually his best. Very seldom was his second or third. He was right. And this has always been a quirk of his. He liked to do his first take in singing also. all those famous numbers he did were usually one-take numbers, which I hated because I get better as I do 10 takes on a musical number, you know. But at any rate, no, he did start from scratch. He didn't know left foot from right. He couldn't got into a military squadron without trouble. But we laugh about that.
In the picture Kelly's talking about, Anchors Away, Sinatra played a silly goon called Clarence Doolittle, afraid of women, shy to the point of self-effacement. It helped to build up his international popularity, and the tap dancing was an enjoyable novelty. But it was not what posterity would be looking for. When it came to the ballads, there was nobody who could raise the hairs on the neck of a whole generation like Sinatra. In one sense, 1944 was the peak of the career of Sinatra's greatest professional rival, Bing Crosby, although each represented different generations of listeners and fans. As early as 1941, before Sinatra had registered with many people, he was already the hero of a youth cult. At least he was, according to the novelist John O'Hara, who in 1958 published a novel called From the Terrace, in which the following exchange appears between a mother and her teenage daughter.
Mommy?
What, dear?
Do you like Frank Sinatra?
I don't know Frank Sinatra.
Do you like his singing?
Not very much.
Oh, you're as bad as Alex. Alex says he sounds like a lost calf, and he does not.
But he does to Alex. What does he sound like to you?
Nothing. He sounds like Frank Sinatra.
Well, I like Al Jolson.
Oh, Mommy.
Your father likes Bing Crosby.
He imitates Frank Sinatra.
I think, if anything, it's the other way.
Well, that debate wasn't the only one in which Sinatra featured once he became famous. He became active politically. Coming out for Roosevelt's fourth term, he was accused of being a pink and a red. He fought with sponsors. He was pilloried by some of the press, and he did his best to pillory them back. He won an Oscar for his picture, The House I Live In, A Plea for Racial Tolerance. In 1947, he hit his first newspaper hack. By 1948, with tastes in popular music changing fast and drifting downwards, Sinatra, who not so long before had literally stopped the New York traffic, was spotted by Sammy Davis Jr. walking down Broadway. He was alone, and apparently nobody recognized him. By this time, he was being ludicrously misused by the Hollywood moguls. Although whether by design or through pure stupidity, it's hard to say. One time, I asked Catherine Grayson about working with Sinatra on that bad joke of a picture, The Kissing Bandit. And she said...
Well, with Kissing Bandit, we both looked at each other and said, what are we going to do for a comeback? I mean, they play it sometimes on the late, late, late tardy shows, and it's so ridiculous that it's funny.
Miss Grayson at that point asked us to switch off the tape recorder and then confided that she always suspected that The Kissing Bandit was somebody's attempt to sabotage the Sinatra career. By the end of the decade, a lot of people either believed that or seemed to be actually doing it. Sinatra's fall was as rapid as his rise and just as melodramatic. The breakup of his first marriage, the much-publicized beginning of his second to Ava Gardner, and an apparent rejection of what he was doing at the microphone, coupled with bad publicity, created an impression of a five-minute wonder on the way out. It was all nonsensical, but it must have been hard for Sinatra to live with at the time, knowing, as he certainly did, that so far from being finished, vocally speaking, he'd hardly started.
I'm a fool to want you. I'm a fool to want you. To want a love that can't be true. A love that's there for others too. I'm a fool to hold you. Such a fool to hold you, to seek a kiss not mine alone, to share a kiss the devil has known. Time and time again I said I'd leave you. Time and time again come the time when I would need you, and once again these words I'd have to say. Take me back, I love you. Pity me, I need you. I know it's wrong, it must be wrong, but right or wrong, I can't get along.
That recording dates back to 1952. It was the time of Johnny Ray and Frankie Lane. And crazy as it now seems that anyone could conceivably prefer either of those two cart horses to a thoroughbred like Sinatra, that's the way it was. By the end of the year, the marriage to Ava Gardner was the delight of the gossip columnists. The collector of taxes was behaving in his predictable style. The recording contract with Columbia Records expired, and believe it or not, no other company moved in to sign him up. To sum up, Sinatra was bad news. He had no movie work, no recording contract, and no happiness from his marriage. Anyone with any sense would probably have called it a day and gone out and got a job. Not Sinatra. Capitol Records finally offered him a one-year contract. Sinatra to pay all orchestration and musician costs. And no advance. From the first, the Capitol arrangement worked like a charm. It was the beginning of the Sinatra-Nelson-Riddle alliance that changed the face of popular music. And it coincided with something else. Deep in his trough of defeat in 1952, Sinatra had read a novel by James Jones, which had been sold to Columbia Pictures. It was called From Here to Eternity.
You vowed your love from here to eternity, a love so true it never would die. You gave your lips, so willingly, how could I know your kiss meant goodbye? Now I'm alone with only a memory. My empty arms will never know why. Though you are gone, this love that you left with me will live from here to eternity.
And that's it. See you same time next week.
Now I'm alone with only a memory. My empty arms we'll never know why, though you are gone. This love that you left with me, this endless desire, will live from here to eternity.
You've been listening to In the Benny Green Archives here on lgradio.online. Please do visit the website to find out when the next episode is on, along with all our other shows. This is lgradio.online. Thanks for listening.